Happy Monday, everybody. How you doing?
Happy Monday. Welcome, Tony.
Hey, good morning, Matt. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
The right order.
Whichever.
We're
basically interchangeable.
We're interchangeable. That's right.
Yeah. that's cool. So I hope everyone had a good weekend. It sounds like you had great weather in New York or Jersey area where you guys are at.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty nice. I mean, just kind of spent a lot of the weekend outside walking around, and it's very spring-like. I mean, one day the high was almost 70, and then another day it was 55. So, yeah.
And I was with my Sunday morning bike group yesterday, and we did our usual turnout to Morristown. It was a glorious spring day.
What kind of biking? Do you do like road biking or mountain biking? What kind of biking do you do?
Kind of a combination of, it's funny about that. When I first got it back into biking, I thought I would be really into the trail stuff, but I finally enjoyed the road stuff better. One is that you got to think of, at least in the Northeast, maybe different in other parts of the country, but like Northeast, you get more varied, landscapes on the road. Whereas like if you're going on an old rail trail, well, like all those farmlands, well, all those forests grew back in. So you just go through miles and miles of forest. I find myself liking road biking better, which surprised me.
That's pretty cool.
Have you ever cycled to Minneapolis? I forget if I asked you this before.
No.
Really good cycling town if you ever take a vacation out there, because they have these bike highways that go right through the middle of town.
So oh, cool.
It might be worth checking out. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. What I love about actually where I am in the whole place is Jersey. You think of Jersey like Sopranos and oil refineries on the Jersey Turnpike and Meadowlands and swamps. But actually, you go to Northwest Jersey, it's like, nobody's thought about it. It's like it's this like this little quiet little corner that nobody knows about, and it's like perfect biking country.
I'd never have thought that, because when you're thinking of New Jersey, I think of Sopranos, oil refineries,
New York City.
Yeah.
So with its hills and dales and quiet little country roads, because basically everybody's racing off to the Poconos.
So
quiet little corner that nobody knows about.
My brother has bears come through his yard. I mean, that's not what people think
of. Not Tony bears. But
no. Yeah. Like
I knew there was somebody that there. Oh, okay. All right.
Okay. We just killed the morning. Okay. Well, awesome. Well, it's good to have you here, Tony. I guess for people who don't know who you are, do you want to give a quick intro?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm Tony Bear. So it's 2 4-letter words. And I'm basically I run an independent analyst firm, DB Insight. And my core swim lane is data. And we'll be talking about how with data, it means you have to basically know about adjoining swim lanes. But I've been basically following databases since before it was fashionable for about the past, say 25 years, something like that. I did make for about a 5 or 6 year period in the early aughts. It was during the time when internet was just killing transaction systems. I did make a detour into middleware, and yes, I became I went on the 12-step program to recover from being a service-oriented architecture SOA-aholic. So I have fully repented for those middleware days. I'm back in data.
And generative AI lately. So,
Well, put it this way. Here's the deal. I try and stay as close to my lane as possible because I try not to be a jackass of all trades, but the thing is that in data, you have to know about all these other areas because they touch data, and data touches them. And so, for instance, something as boring and dry as storage, I could care less about it, except that it does shape, the way you design a database. Same with network topology to a lesser extent, compute. But again, also with AI, it both, it impacts in terms of how you run a database and what you do with a database. And in turn, data is the fuel for AI. So you just can't ignore it.
Oh, completely agree. And frankly, I think that generative AI-based companies have been ignoring it. And that is a major reason for many of their biggest problems right now, like various lawsuits that OpenAI
faces. What makes you say that, Matt?
So specifically, and I've talked to various friends about this too. So I was talking to Makiko Basley about it, and the incentives right now for people working on generative AI models are just to shovel as much data as possible into their models without really no filtering, no governance, no legal checks that's starting to change, but like that's been the convention. And so now we're seeing lawsuits over copyright, we're seeing lawsuits over hate speech and all kinds of other things that this approach has led to.
So is generative AI basically like the data lake 2.0 in that regard?
Seems like it. Tony, what's your opinion on that? I mean, what did you see during the data lake era? I think we probably all saw similar things.
We had all these arguments being, you know, data lake, you know, becoming data swamp because we all were under the illusion that cloud storage was cheap, and relative to other forms of storage, it was. One, a lot of cheap gets expensive, but the other thing is, what are we pouring in there? And then what are the things we are doing about with this data? We didn't mean to traipse over anybody's privacy, but did we basically let out some social security numbers? And now, especially say where you have data nationalism, you know, are we tripping over data sovereignty? So there's so many minefields. Plus also, of course, all the data that's up the internet, of course, it must be true. So you get that it's just, really trying to get a handle on all the data that's coming in is proving minefield. But I think there's also, even if all that data were good, the fact is that can we all afford to be open, you know, open AI? Can we afford to basically just scour the whole of the internet just in terms of the cost, the carbon footprint? And so I think what we're starting to look at, and I think, the fact that we're talking about RAG, retrieval augmented generation, is a really constructive step in this direction, is that we really need to focus on the data that's important, that's relevant to solving business problems.
Yeah, exactly. And what you exclude from the training is almost as important as what you include. Removing data that's going to mislead people or data that's actually machine generated itself and going to degrade your model is going to be a significant problem, but also opportunity for improvement in the future.
Sure.
So you've written some articles. Let me see, the Data 2024 Outlook, Data Meets Generative AI. We'll start with that. You sent some awesome articles, and thanks for doing that. Everything you write is amazing, by the way, but this in particular... And a couple other articles we'll get into. What's that?
Flattery will get you somewhere.
We'll get you on the show, so it works. What are you seeing? What's the outlook? I know it's the title of this conversation here. What's happening with generative AI in 2024?
Okay. Well, first off, I think what's happened with generative AI is I just wrote a couple of pieces actually subsequent to that, to the data, outlook. And it's just that I saw a lot of, I've been around the block a couple times, even though I do dye my hair gray to get take more seriously. But I'm a natural brunette.
Me too.
Yeah. But anyway, I just see a lot of similarities, a lot of parallels, with the original internet frenzy, the dot-com frenzy of like the late 1990s. And the thing is that it's not that it all was for naught. I mean, the internet became a real force, but we got a little overexcited with the sock puppets of pets.com. And the things with Gen AI, I've got to hand it to OpenAI, which is that they knew how to strike a chord. And basically coming out with now, it's I guess almost about a year and a half ago of releasing, I guess, a beta version or something like that. We all do betas these days, of ChatGPT, where now you could ask questions and get back answers that are essentially the equivalent of an essay written by a high school senior without any footnotes. And about as reliable as that. But the fact is that it sees the public imagination. Now, this is not the first time we've had AI. We've had AI for years, but more specifically over the last 10 years, we've had an explosion in machine learning. But it's not noticeable because, where machine learning will tend to come in is like underneath the surface, kind of like the recommendation engines that we've looked at your pattern of behavior, we predict that this is the offer you're going to most likely respond to. But that's not really visible to the average person, whereas the average person can go up on, on OpenAI, in ChatGPT and ask a question, and it's right out in front of them. And it's like a short step from the way Captain Kirk talk to his computers in Star Trek, which now I think you can, which is, computer, please give me the coordinates of the closest star, of the closest Starfleet. And the computer will come out in its modulated voice. This is what it is, but I don't think you should try and go there. And that captured the public imagination. And so it's kind of like, it was kind of like the iPhone, which is that, in the last about 10 or 15 years, ever since the iPhone, it's been consumers that have been leading in adoption of technology. Enterprises have kind of had to, lagged, and or I should say, they've been looking at consumers for the lead, like tail wagging the dog. And so first you had this profusion of mobile apps on the App Store, and then enterprises started realizing, we could use this. And I think it's the same thing that's rolling out with Gen AI, but where it differs, with mobile, even though we certainly went through a shakedown period, with Gen AI, we're only at the beginning of this journey. And the fact is that outside of a few, I think, pretty obvious use cases to start off with, which are code generators, which themselves have their own issues, document summarization, natural language query. Other than that, the real heavy lift of what Gen AI is going to do, that's years away from now. But yet the investment that's required to get this all going, and I'm not just, the hardware is one thing. H100 is going for $20,000 a pop or whatever the number is on the spot market these days. And the fact there's a shortage, and the fact that we need to to build all these foundation models to get this going, but yet we need to train all these models, but yet it's very hard to get training time because there's a shortage of GPUs. And then there's the question of, okay, what types of use cases are enterprises really going to benefit from? And my own gut is that it's going to be very vertical use cases that are good, but it's a type of thing that's only going to develop over time. But what's happening right now is, let's say, it's a big sucking sale. It's sucking up all the investment. It's sucking up the jobs. We've seen lots of layoffs, not because the big hyperscalers are looking for the business to go down. So they realize they need to change. They need to get rid of some of those marketers, those metaverse folks, and they need folks that are skilled Gen AI developers, the people that know their way around that. So it's a huge displacement at the moment. The industry is going to have to spend a lot of money on this. But enterprises are not going to really be paying for this heavily for, I would say, outside of some early use cases, for at least 3 or 4 years down the road. So it's a huge disconnect in the short term.
And it is very reminiscent of the dot-com boom,
There
was so much money and there was so much excitement. And I would argue, back then it was very consumer-driven, like people getting on their computers, going to websites, but it wasn't making money. Everyone talked about how it would make money someday, and eventually it did. But it took years and years after the crash for it to really make money for people.
Exactly. And also, just from a technology standpoint, we started with just very simple, websites. Then all of a sudden we got to, we were able to do some stuff with asynchronous JSON, AJAX. So we started to get slightly more dynamic websites. Then we started to get more transactional websites, but it took time for all this to roll out. And yes, it did, but it took at least about 10 years. It was 10 years past when the bubble popped, but it did happen.
I think another interesting parallel is the security side of things, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but the early web was not secure. They started to do things like SSL, but it just wasn't, in terms of handling secure payment information and such, it wasn't there. It was very easy to hack. And we see a parallel thing with Gen AI, where Gen AI does a lot of really dangerous stuff, like generate really bad answers that can cause problems. What do you think about that parallel?
Well, are you accusing Gen AI of hallucinating?
I would never do such a thing.
I am shocked. I'm not an expert on security, but the thing is that I think if you look at one aspect of it, which is basically the reliability of the information, the veracity, reliability. There's a huge potential problem there. I think there are ways to deal with this. But especially if we're basically combing the general internet, take a look at some of the, obviously, you can in extreme cases, you can get, ChatGPT to come up with some stuff that's pretty bizarre. But also, like when Google recently released an image generator for Gemini, and it turned out that some of those images, like having blacks, basically appear, and I think it was like, in Nazi helmets or something like that. It was something like that. It's like, this stuff obviously could not have happened. Just ask Jesse Owens in the 36 Olympics. But the thing is that, there is that problem because it's the nature of these transformer models, which is that unlike machine learning, where you basically, it's a mathematical regression, these transformer models, these language models, actually, it's not just language, but I'll just say transformer models. They're basically probability models on steroids that get down to such, abstract level, like what word is likely to follow the previous word, or what pixel is likely to, connect to this other pixel, or could be molecular structure. We think of it as language models, but it's more than that. But it's the very construct of how these models are built does not have any context. Now, maybe there might be a Gen 2.0 where we could start to put some of that in. I know right now we seem to be trying to edit after the fact, but that's an enormous problem. Where I think it's solvable is when basically enterprises, as I said, I think at least for enterprises, there is an answer, which is stick with your own data. And there, it's less, using the language model, you may get some combinations that are a little bizarre, but should hopefully be easier to spot because you are hopefully the master of your own corpus of data. Hopefully. That may be a bit naive.
Well, as David Albrecht says here, hallucinations are a feature in some cases, like a security, not so much. So
somebody's listening to us.
I was actually I was climbing yesterday with a professor friend of mine, and he teaches data analytics at the University of Utah, and had been going very deeply into just he said he'd been using like ChatGPT like 7 hours a day to sort of figure out how to like the angles of it that he could use in teaching students what was traditionally a kind of traditional data and analytics background, right? Visualization, statistics, that kind of stuff, right? And then his whole thing was, okay, so to what extent should I just let this rip with students and just let them use this? And then how do I teach a class, and are they going to learn anything? And I think another professor he mentioned had taken 15 weeks of coursework and in 1.5 hours solved all of the coursework.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Well, what this reminds me of a little bit is when calculators first came in.
Yes.
So are students still going to learn math? And the thing is, there is something to be said for the fact of when you don't do this by hand and you're just relying on something it's a different set of skills. But on the other hand, I'm going to sound a little old fashioned here, which is that my sense is you should really know, how the sausage is made before you start using machines to make the sausage. But I think that's a really good question that you were having with your climbing friend, which is that you can't, it's kind of like you can't stop, plate tectonics here. These tools are going to be reality. And so, I certainly don't have the answers there, but now we have to figure out a way to kind of like, how do we use this, but still require that you get to at least know the basics before you start stuff.
I don't know about you, Matt. I know at the University of Utah, when I was doing my math degree, they didn't let us use calculators, I think, the entire course.
For grad school, it really didn't matter that much.
Didn't need them.
I guess, like, usually calculators were not the issue. Maybe you use them once in a while if you need to do a big calculation or something.
Right.
I'm trying to think. I mean, we didn't generally allow them on exams when I was teaching math classes, but we also tried to keep the math fairly simple. And if it was something complicated like sine or cosine or log, obviously, you're going to do that with a calculator, right? It makes no sense to try to do that by hand unless you're working a very specific calculus problem.
Oh, no, you can figure out cosine of pi over 6 in your head.
Yeah, that's easy. Yeah, the standard angles, in radians. Yeah,
but,
for sure.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting thing. I remember my actuary exams, I could use like the 10x, whatever, the cheapest TI calculator you could find. Right. So it's like you can add and subtract and that's about it. But yeah, I think it's, I don't know what the guardrails are in terms of teaching, but I think it highlights a bigger issue. And this is sort of the more of the existential issue that when I zoom out, this is what everyone's trying to figure out is, okay, so like, how is this stuff going to be used? Where does it augment and actually where does it make us dumber? So, cause like my whole, conversation with this professor was, and Matt and I also teach at the school, but it's, how are you going to serve the student in the best way, right? Where they come out being able to use these tools in a productive manner versus using them basically as a cheat, as a comfort blanket. And they actually are worse off in the workplace, because they literally don't know their job function at all. They're just, everything's a chat query. I don't know.
Here's a thought, and I'm taking this from, and it's kind of interesting. This is bringing back, some memories of my school days. Back in the log cabin.
What did you study again in college?
I was history and journalism, but the irony of all this is that I actually tested best in math. I just got lazy and trig in high school because, I didn't have calculators at that point. Like, I just didn't like, dividing 8 points, 0.863 by, or multiplying 0.863 by 0.367. I just didn't like doing that. I could do it. I just got too lazy. But the thing is that what was really instructive, was when in school, when in college, I took an organic chem course for non-majors, and I didn't know it then, but that really I didn't realize, but that was actually the next chapter of my life. That's actually what turned out to be my career. I just didn't realize it at the time. And the thing is, what he taught it was, he said, look, we know you're not going to go on in the major, so we're not going to teach this as a memorization course. We're going to teach this as a logic course. And you look at the way organic works. It's basically different mathematical combinations of four elements. And teaching it in that logical manner, if to someone who is not part of the field, gave me a feel for, for the discipline, to the point where at the end of the semester, we had a chance to, we had the choice to take a final or write a paper. So, I'll just BS my way through a paper. And it turned out to be fascinating exercise because I ended up doing a paper looking at the biochemical difference between short-term and long-term memory. And what I found was that once some of these, 10-syllable words were defined for me, once I just was, the terminology was defined, there was a logic. And so I got an understanding of it. So I think the point I'm trying to make here is that I think a way to teach basically practitioners in a certain area might be to force them to use their school, their skills, their skills in an adjunct area. And which forces them to use the same mental processes, but in an area that's unfamiliar to them. I think that might actually be kind of a key.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, as a writer, so you've just talked about this experience of getting into writing in college. What are your thoughts on ChatGPT as like an automation of writing? Tell me about that.
Well, okay, and I'm going to be very old school here. Because that I will use ChatGPT at this point like I used Wikipedia. So I'm going to ask it for very, in other words, like if I have a concept in my head, like define what basically is a transformer model. I know what it is, but I like to take a look at the definition right in front of me because I'm figuring that on something like that, it's probably not going to hallucinate. I do not want to use it for basically trying to, to find out what happened at a specific point in time or anything like that. I really do not trust that. So right now, so from that standpoint, I'll use it as that. I also understand that, unfortunately, we're going to find lots of, lots of basically companies, whether it's in the media field, in the marketing field, that are just going to use this to replace people and just churn out junk. I mean, there's always been, and so I'm very concerned about that. I'm probably, you know, so in the short term, I'm not exactly bullish on ChatGPT. I am bullish in the long term on very domain-specific transformer models that are trained on specific relevant corpus of data. But I also know that this thing is out there, the toothpaste is out of the tube, and so it's going to be junk. It's just that there'll be more junk. Just like, for instance, there are today, I was on, I won't mention it, but it was on watching a podcast about ethical marketing, and they're saying, look, you know, and they were talking about some trends in the analyst and influencer business where some were basically just using click farms, and so you might get, you know, and you might, so you might get 5 views and 50,000 likes. And the thing is that I think we are going to be seeing that, you know, it's going to be impossible to police this. So I am fearful of that.
When it comes back to, I think there's a couple of threads that you bring up too. There's some stat, I can't remember if it's true or not, but I think it was predicted by 2025, i.e. in a few months, that, what was it, 90, 95% of data on the internet will be AI generated or synthetic. I don't know if that's true or not, but at some point you can imagine a future where, it's exactly what you say, it reminds me a lot of like processed foods in this case, right? Where it's low nutritional value, it's really bad for you. And this is unfortunately the reality where it's going to be pervasive everywhere. And the only people who can afford the equivalent of like Whole Foods are the affluent. These are the equivalent of subscriptions to reputable news sources. You know, that's gonna be out of the reach for most people. So most people are gonna be living in this sea of just drivel, like the Pacific garbage patch, but that's like the internet now. And that's the reality of it.
Well, I'll put it this way. We've been living, I mean, there's nothing to do, you know, from that standpoint, in that people are going to basically, you know, gravitate to whatever, you know, source of information they have. I will say that basically that this goes beyond AI towards more, I mean, towards areas that I think are well beyond my pay grade to really, but the thing is that I compare, you know, for instance, like with, if you look at anything that's going on in the news right now and all the different interpretations versus what happened during the Watergate era, where essentially we had, we all got our news from essentially we shared a common set of facts. And we had basically, our main news came from either, you know, the three networks, or we had strong local newspapers, which were in the business of journalism. Of course, yes, you had yellow journalism. Whereas today, essentially, you have, you know, you just subscribe to the viewpoint that's, you know, that you know resonates with your echo chamber. So I think the problem goes beyond AI generating this stuff. I think AI can make that worse. But the thing is, I think what I'd rather stick to here is talk about how we can basically take advantage of this in the business world, because I think because otherwise I think we're just going to try and boil the ocean.
Oh, we will. And the thing is, the other thread I was going to get to, and this will tie back to the business, is a governance piece, right? So it's exactly the what you're talking about earlier, where there's going to be more and more. I think it was about 5 minutes into the conversation, we're talking about just the amount of AI generated data out there, but like governance is going to be a huge, huge issue. And this is something you talk about in your SiliconANGLE articles too. Walk us through this. Why is governance important for data in an age of AI?
Well, governance has always been important for data. It's just that the stakes are just greater. Yeah. The stakes got greater first off when we got beyond, I mean, traditionally, you know, data was in our own walled gardens, supplemented by what we used to call syndicated data from like first like IRI or Nielsen or whatever, or other data brokers. And that model's obviously expanded, but now with the internet, where you can basically reach into lots of public sources of information and get things like anonymized, like, you know, mobile phone movements and stuff like that, and GPS data. All the stuff gets magnified. And then of course you have the question of what's the provenance of the data, you know, or is there some nefarious actors that are basically generating purposely spurious data? So the thing is that I think when you get into this is why I tend to be very, very cynical about basically trying to scrape the internet for data. Mm. On the other hand, I think as an enterprise, there are things you can do. One, I mean, and a lot of enterprises do not, I mean, right now, just getting a hold, just getting a handle on the data within their own organizations is challenging enough. But it is a doable problem. It's just one that are they willing to, you know, to put the investment in. You multiply that now with, you know, with something, or you know, with the fact that we now have tools that we can do things with this data, especially when we start using, you know, transformer models. And now essentially, you know, I mean, there's some very good uses that they can be put to. I think one of the best uses is the whole idea of document summarization, entity extraction. It's finding that needle in the haystack. And if you basically train this, if you basically point this at your huge corpus of emails and documents and contracts, you know, and data like that, I think that can be really constructive. On the other hand, you know, the flip side, you know, we were talking about the, and that's one way, and that's a good use of this technology for governance. When we start, you know, if we start using all our data, you know, essentially, with minimal oversight, then you can get into trouble, because chances are, in your customer records, you probably have data that should not, you know, be out there, or in an age, as I said, of data nationalism, data sovereignty, you may not be able to use, there may be great restrictions on what form you can use data that comes out of a certain country. And so I think there are just, it multiplies the governance challenges. The other thing also is that with transformer models, because as I said before, the way they put this stuff together, it's just, they go very low level. It's just what they go low level without context. Yep. It raises the stakes on, could something go wrong here? So yeah, I think governance is more important than ever. I think it's more, I mean, it's one thing to basically to do governance over, let's say, machine learning, where basically there is a logic to that. There is context to machine learning. There is no context to transformer models. And so that means that you have to, you know, put in an extra layer of vigilance, and we're still learning our way through that. There are no real answers to that yet.
Well, when you, kind of backing up too, in this article you had the giant sucking sound of generative AI that came out, a few weeks ago, end of February. I'm going to quote a Harris poll conducted for a consulting firm Insight Enterprises revealed 2/3 of business leaders reported already using generative AI within the organizations, with just over half citing productivity as the prime benefits. And the main use cases, I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but visualization of data analysis, copilots for summarizing email and other documents, and generation of content. I can't imagine these are the domain specific models you're talking about now. These are the general purpose ones, right?
Yeah.
I guess in light of that, what are the steps needed for companies to move from using these sort of general purpose tools? For example, right, I use a Gemini Advanced in Google Docs now, and I think it's awesome for what it does. It's also extremely limited for what it does. It's right. A very general tool. What do you think that the bridge is between these Gemini Advanced and the Microsoft Copilots and so forth for today versus these vertical industry domain specific generative AI that you need to get to?
Well, first off, I want to put a little bit of context there. My first reaction to that survey was, maybe 2/3 of companies are using it, but it's kind of like a mile wide and an inch deep. In other words, I think it counts companies that are maybe using it just for like a few things. They're tipping.
Yeah.
I'm sure every company is like dipping their toes in the water, so I don't doubt that.
Yep.
I think essentially what you need to do is be very disciplined with the use cases. And put this on, and understand it for what it is, and also know your data sources, know what data that you're using for this. And so, if you're just training on your own, you know, corpus of documents, I'd say that's a good thing. On the other hand, if that model is a model that was trained on the internet, it may be making associations from your documents that may be kind of weird. And the thing is that every industry has its own you know, has its own jargon or its own way of using expressions. And I remember there was a case years ago. This has nothing with Gen AI, but just how how terminology, common use terminology, can be just twisted out of context. There was that climate data from the University of East Anglia, and someone's using the term, let's trick the data. Well, they weren't really tricking the data. It was just a term used for basically doing some manipulation. But those that were outside said, see, it's obvious they're falsifying the data. And so those are the types of things that you really need to be really careful about if you're using models, if you're relying on models that were trained on basically just general language usage and not on your usage of language.
Let me ask a question about companies, the traditional tech companies, our FANG companies, as we still call them, having huge piles, huge troves of data versus the small upstarts like OpenAI. Yeah. Do you think that the disruption by small startups is going to continue where they're going to dominate the big companies, or will those big troves of data that Google, Amazon, Facebook, Meta own allow them to shift to be the dominant players again?
That, put it this way, if they don't trip over themselves, then they certainly do have a huge head start. I'll take it even a step behind that, which is that the entry level, the barriers to entry for startups with Gen AI are a lot higher than they were with internet companies, cloud companies. So let's just even go back to that for a second, which is that when the cloud came in, it really opened the floodgates for startups, because guess what? They didn't have to buy their own servers, their own infrastructure. Because basically all the startups back in like the 90s and early 2000s had to buy their own stuff. And then when Amazon came along, we can just rent this stuff in the cloud and we don't have to buy this. It opened that plus the fact of easy capital opened the floodgates. Now, fast forward to today, and one, just trying to get that, if you want to, start up and build some new foundation models, you need to do a lot of heavy training. You need to get a lot of expensive compute time, which is kind of right now there is a shortage. So that's raised the barrier there. Then, of course, we have the higher interest rates, and the VCs are giving to the big guys, but they're not, but the thing is there, but clearly, venture funding has dropped down. So I think there, and then you add, Matt, what you're talking about, which is the huge data advantage that the FANG companies have, or the Magnificent Seven or whatever. There are a lot of structural factors that will make it a lot more difficult for startups. On the other hand, as I said, though, big companies can trip. And the thing is, like Facebook, basically, they got, Mark Zuckerberg had this thing for the metaverse and plowed billions of dollars in there. Had he not, basically, he could, that money could have been, could have been funneled, into Gen AI earlier on. I'm not saying Facebook is suffering real heavily for that. They're big enough that they could absorb it. But the other thing is, I look at Google, which I think is making some notable, makes some notable progress now, but they basically, their folks, their research, they came up with the transformer model. Yet all those researchers left Google. And look, I give Google, credit, they're certainly very much, still very much in the game, but just imagine if they'd been able to keep those people. In other words, they would have stolen it. They would have basically had, made the first move beyond, before OpenAI if they still had all those people.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, my impression still is that Google is such a technology leader, and yet they seem to be tripping over themselves on the organization and business side with this technology in a way that OpenAI is not, where OpenAI was able to capture the public imagination and get this technology out there in front of people very quickly.
I agree with you on that, but I kind of disagree a little bit there too, because the thing is, right now, OpenAI is this halo. And the thing is that, yes, they have it by virtue of the fact they have this huge consumer machine. Okay. I think Google is eventually going to get it. And I look at it in terms of just the way they're doing cloud. They're still number three in cloud, but they are approaching it differently from Azure and Amazon. And so I certainly would not count Google out. But yes, did they have they made some missteps? Yes, they have. I would not count them out.
But it's still super early days.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, it's basically us arguing about like Yahoo and GeoCities at this point. It's like, okay, the world does move on at some point.
We know the world use Yahoo Maps, right?
Everyone does in MapQuest. I still use MapQuest.
MapQuest. But you brought up some other interesting points too. It was Anthropic. I mean, they spend half their funding and training right now. I think that's the stat, right? That's a lot of money. And in fact, The Information had an article on this too, where it was the, I can't remember when, it was maybe last month or something, but the talked about basically AI startups are sort of at this juncture where they either need to get more money to fund more training,
right?
Or they need to sell. Basically,
because
in the past, in the startup, as you point out, in the cloud days, in the 2010s, you raise a bunch of money, you hire a bunch of people, cloud, infrastructure costs are pretty, they are what they are, cheapish. Yeah. Exact opposite problem now. If literally half of your funding is going towards training, what else do you have? You still have OPEX in your business, right?
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to be a little Pollyannish here.
Yeah,
that we're going to start. And this is going to come of necessity because the fact is that we can't be throwing all this compute against all this data. It's just not going to be sustainable. Just the carbon footprint of this is just going to be pretty hellacious. But number two is that I think what we're going to, I think business is going to drive this, which is that we need to train this on relevant data.
Right, right.
But one thing is, I think what we are going to, so I think wisdom and learning curve here, and pun intended, is really going to come in because we're going to look at like just how much data will be enough to do this right, especially when we basically establish the context. We basically put some firm guardrails around this. I'm a firm believer in that. One, we're going to start to figure out how to do this more efficiently as we get more experience. Right now, we're just throwing up a lot of mud at the wall and hoping some of it sticks. That is not a long-term strategy. It's a strategy for experimenting in the beginning. So I'm an optimist there, but on the other hand, it's going to take about 3-4 years for us to really, figure that out. So I'm actually a little more optimistic there, but in the short run, I'm a pessimist, but long run, I'm an optimist.
What are your thoughts on small language models for businesses?
That's basically, I think that, the meek shall inherit the earth. I mean, basically, I think that's one is the only way that's, well, for two things. One is the only thing that's going to be affordable and sustainable, but number two, relevant. Because basically businesses are not trying to solve the same type of question that, let's say, a consumer version of ChatGPT is trying to solve. We're trying to solve something that's very specific to the business that you do. And let's say like you're in life sciences, now, of course, that's very data intensive, but it's still a subset of the data that you have on the internet. It's data that's specifically relevant to basically, to clinical data, to molecular structure. So it's very well defined. I probably picked a poor example there because that's a very data intensive area, but still that's going to be a subset of training on the entire internet. And I think, or your logistics company. So you're looking at, okay, we have weather data, we have traffic data, we have, IoT data, basically coming, from the truck itself, that's instrumented, and we have some data from the manufacturer. Those are defined corpuses of data, and it's finite. So I am a firm optimist that in the long run, that smaller language models that are going to be trained appropriately and will essentially will win out. It's the same juncture where I look at, for instance, like how databases. Just getting back into my lane.
I was about to ask you about that actually.
Oh, about databases, because I don't know Jack about Gen AI, which is that right now everybody's over the past year, we all have vector storage. It's just another form of data. That's not a huge concept leap, but the indexes, they're different. Right now they just say, we have indexing. Well, chances are they have a flat index, which is fine when you're starting out and it's small and simple problem. But the thing is that, you look at, let's say, like Pinecone or Milvus, then they each have about a dozen indexes. The fact is there are different levels and different types of fact search that you need to do, or should say, similarity search. And some cases, like if you're generating content, you don't need something that's so exact, whereas something like I'm doing document entity extraction, I want to find basically that it let out a social security number. I want something that's going to be more exact. And there are different types of indexes. Some use graphs, some use, like certain like inverted, search indexes, and there are variants of them all. So I think you're going to see a lot of innovation there. Right now, most of the database folks are basically saying, yeah, we have vector storage and we have a vector index. But I think you're going to see a lot more differentiation going forward.
Well, I'm still curious to watch how Gen AI itself will become an indexing tool. And I don't think we're there yet, right? There are so many examples of generated outputs with no references. And we need the footnotes. We need the references to make this work correctly. Yeah.
Yeah. Number one, I think when you basically have a finite model, you can build that in. Obviously, with ChatGPT, where you're doing the whole internet, but the thing is that I think you can. I'm not going to say it's, problem totally solved, but I think it's more solvable when you basically have a defined corpus of data, number one. Number two, though, that it's not, the way that a transformer model works, and we'll take a language model, the most obvious example, is the transformer model is not going to say why I put this word in front of that word. What it can do is say, these are the sources that I got this from. So that's certainly a step up. It doesn't necessarily, if you basically have a hallucination, let's say in the output that your well-defined, foundation model that's only working on your corpus of data works, you're not going to be able to find the smoking gun exactly, but you'll be able to narrow it down. But there's another thing I want to take your argument the other way, which is that pointing Gen AI at databases, this is the operational side.
Yep.
And the thing is, you can use this, some of this entity extraction to basically go into the metadata and explain what's in the database. Digest that with some of the documentation. And that, that could be an incredible discovery tool. And in a way, it can provide another form of indexing. And it could all, and so I think basically Gen AI is applied to the database. And I know, I think Databricks is doing some work in that area right now. I think, will be incredibly helpful. But the thing is, we have to distinguish between, using AI, to run the databases versus AI to basically, work on results coming from the database.
And I think eventually we'll get to the point where that integration is much stronger. I mean,
RAG
right now is still the dominant paradigm, right? But you still have very much a separation between I query the database, I pull that data out, I feed it into the model, as opposed to kind of interstitiating these two parts.
Yeah, and that's the type of thing, that comes with time. I mean, because actually, what's kind of cool with RAG and with Gen AI, to BI query, said BI, okay, we got the data, we put it in these visualizations. What Gen AI will do is it'll go into the other data, which is the 90% of data that exists in your organization outside, the non-tabular data, the so-called unstructured data. And it can lend context. It can help you really build a story around it, a narrative around the data. So I think that'd be really cool, but it's going to take time to figure out how to blend these together, but that's going to happen. And that would be amazing. Cool. But again, done within the context of a finite and well-defined, corpus of data.
Since you've written your articles, has there been anything else in the data or AI landscape that's you've been really fascinated by?
Well, as I said, it's really, Gen AI is really it's the elephant in the room. It's really hard. The fact is, look, I think that this is not exciting, sexy stuff, but I think the lake house is gradually becoming more and more reality. About a year ago, I spent about 6 months going, pouring into this. And the result was, I did two forms of reports. I did a short and a long report. And the long report was, kind of went down into the weeds technically. And my conclusion at the end is that I just spent 20 pages talking about the technical differences, but By the way, those technical differences don't matter. But I needed to do that to inoculate myself, you know, against like, well, you didn't know that, like, this one does streaming, you know, streaming updates better than that one, and this one, does better insertions. I'm saying in the long run, these are, you know, this stuff is so trivial. What's really all about is you have this open table format, which means that this data is now accessible. You can really take it and you can make, and it's a way of, well, I've also called it very often the SQL nerd's revenge on the data lake. In that it's giving you a lot of the, basically most of the performance, the ability to govern, that you have in a data warehouse applied to the data lake, which expands the canvas. What's really interesting was there was and I was just doing just commenting on LinkedIn recently. Snowflake has been really aggressive with embracing the lakehouse. And some investment analyst was talking, was seizing on their latest quarterly report. It says, say in the short run, we're going to take a hit on storage. And they were ragging about that, no pun intended in this case. and I'm saying, guys, that's a short run hit, term hit. Ultimately, Snowflake makes its money from compute. And that compute is going to be trained on a much, going to be pointed at a much wider corpus of data. This is a win in the long run, folks. Let's not get fooled here. So I'm actually very bullish about the lakehouse in terms of, to me, it's the natural evolution of the data warehouse.
Yeah.
But that's not going to generate headlines. What's going to generate headlines is Gen AI. It just can't get away from this monster. Last year, around this time, Databricks was gave an advanced briefing on, to analysts, and they were focusing a lot on what they were going with their lakehouse. By the time June came around, it was all Gen AI all the time.
That's
not blame them. It's like it's not that they actually changed their roadmap, but they had to change the focus, because the world basically demanded it. So yeah, that's the reality that we operate under, but it doesn't mean that progress on data has stopped. I think what we're going to be looking at, the other thing, which, and this is more of a longer term issue, is basically the converging of data and AI governance. That has to happen, but right now they're in silos. We're looking at the quality and the provenance of data, and separately, we're looking at basically what we're doing with models. And ultimately, they're interdependent because, like, it's kind of like the surgery was successful, but the patient died. You may have an algorithm that works properly and was very appropriate for the corpus of data that we had a year ago. But since then, things changed and it's not as appropriate. But if you basically just do siloed governance, it's going to take you a lot longer to detect that disconnect and the fact that it was related to the corpus of data that either changed or the quality went south. And so, but nobody's come up with the formula of that yet. And so I'm waiting for that to happen. Now you take this with transformer models, and that just inflates the complexity by ridiculous exponentially. Let's put it that way, because thing is, at least with machine learning model, there's a mathematical logic to this, and so you can connect, and let's say a classification algorithm to, are we misclassifying different cohorts of our market. You can't really do that with a transformer model because it's operating at such a low level. At that point, for instance, like Google basically trying to debug Gemini because the image of Gemini, the image generation side, because it was coming up with some really ridiculous stuff. Repairing that is really complex stuff, and it's not. So the thing is that I look at this as being just, the tip of the iceberg in terms of the type of issues we're going to be dealing with governing transformer models.
Yeah, it brings up an interesting point too, because I can imagine in the case of classical machine learning, and by classical, I mean anything that's not generative AI at this point.
Yeah.
I kind of joke that we're going through the classical machine learning winter right now. Say an algorithm overfits, right? You just you put a regularization component on it, and it doesn't overfit as much.
Right.
But with generative AI, it's almost like you want to overfit to the answer as much as you possibly can, because anything else would be considered a hallucination. So there's so much complexity in this, as you say, that it's just, it's a different beast.
Yeah, no question about that. There's one other thing I want to point to, and has nothing directly to do with that, but more in terms of, you know, the shiny new thing, is that I think there's a big misimpression right now that Gen AI is basically replacing classical AI, if we can call it that, you know, machine learning. No. Basically, if you want an exact answer, you need something more like a machine learning model. If you want basically an answer that gives you general context, yeah, that's where generative comes in. Things, what I see is we're going to be looking at an ensemble approach. Yep. We're going to be using, you know, and I think that's also an area where I think we're going to be getting, where there's going to be a huge focus, on developing expertise, which is, how do we come up with the right combination of models, the right models, plural, for the job. And chances are it's going to be plural models. So it's going to be, making data scientists very busy. So I see, and again, that's not headline stuff, but I see that as being, as we start to figure out how to make, Gen AI, usable, I think we're just going to start to realize, no, we need the right tools, plural, for the job. And figuring that out, that's, that's going to be a major area of development, along with how do we govern all this stuff and make all this stuff accountable. And then there's all the data. Other than that, we don't have much to do.
I have a question for you. Did you see the last week, I guess, Devin, the automated software engineer, stole the week. Did you get a chance to check out that demo?
No, I didn't catch that.
Okay, Devin, go check it out after. It was an interesting demo where this company, it was a Cognition.ai, announced that they came up with the first AI software developer, i.e. you can just give it some instructions and it'll just write a whole project on its own and complete it. So yeah, you should go check it out. Like I said, it demoed really nicely. I have no idea what it actually works like in practice. Yeah, so
it's interesting. That gets in whole, and this is where I get totally outside my zone of competence, but I'm looking more just at the common sense of all this, is that I was on a discussion recently with someone, their contention was that, with regard to all these coding co-pilots, that Gen AI would essentially would increase the market for essentially the low end and basically replace the high. And I said, no, it's just the opposite, because what a co-pilot is going to come out with is basically boilerplate stuff. And chances are, you're going to need somebody who really knows how to optimize this stuff. So when I look at something like what you're talking about, what Devin's doing, I'm sure it certainly ups the stakes, but I think you're still going to need somebody who knows how the sausage is made.
Well, I think there's another issue here, too. I was talking to Andy Petrella about this in Switzerland at Skiers and Data, and that is that these models need high-quality code to train on. And we've already shown research papers that if you feed them the output of other models, they get worse over time. So what happens when we get to the point where there are no human software developers and they're just training on the output of other models? Like, what happens to the quality of code that we're getting?
Well, this sounds like making a JPEG of a JPEG. It's lost in the long run. It's lossy. It's lost. It's kind of like the equivalent of lossy compression, lossy data compression. That the first couple generations may look okay, but eventually, the thing's just going to degrade.
On that cheery note,
Hey, look, like I said, there was a reason why I came out with two pieces the other week. The first part was the rain on the parade, but the other was there's a light at the end of the rainbow, and I used the Wizard of Oz. We go down the yellow brick road, and we will get to wisdom somewhere over the rainbow.
I agree with this. I go. Again, I think to bring it back to the discussion earlier, it definitely feels like it's the old internet days. I think all of us were around for that.
Exactly.
You dye your hair gray, but I know you're around then too. I know. So, but it was definitely a time, I think, of a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of trepidation. Yeah. But here we are. We're talking over the internet right now. It's amazing.
That's true.
And this it's opened up a lot of things. I mean, we socialize on LinkedIn and all that stuff. So who knows? It's inevitability.
We had pets.com sock puppets, but today we have Chewy. You know, think of that.
Alta Vista is my favorite internet example.
I was paid for that product placement.
I'm going to go, who owns that pets.com domain? There's got to be an opportunity there in 2024.
You got any upcoming events, conferences, articles you want to announce?
We're getting into the spring conference season. I'm looking forward to Google Next. Right now I'm working on a report. Google couldn't wait to come out with a whole bunch of database announcements ahead of Next. And the thing is, to me, it's all about how data and AI are really, intertwined. So that note should be coming out within about the next week or so. Nice. And then it's going to be spring conference season. So at that point, since I have nothing to say now, I'll finally have something to say after a couple months.
Looking forward to that. It should be good. Are you going to be at Next, Matt?
I'm sorry?
Not planning to at the moment.
Oh, about you, Joe? Be there? I don't know. Yeah. Somebody said they might get me a ticket there, but I don't know if that's true or not. I'll believe it when I get the ticket.
Come on, sneak in.
It's at Vegas. I mean, I only live, like, it's a 50-minute flight for me to get there. I mean, I just show up for the day. Yeah, it's easy, right? So,
So
who knows? Maybe we'll catch up there. That'd be great.
I'll see you there.
Yeah. Let me see. What's going on this week for moi? I'm going to be in Paris starting Wednesday. I got a book talk club with Ole, Holland Nelson, myself, talking about or O'Reilly books. That'll be a lot of fun. Thursday, speaking at OnePoints conference. OnePoints is the leading data and tech consultancy in France. And I think a lot of other things going on too. I guess KubeCon is going on in Paris too.
I said, how do we pronounce it? Is it KubeCon or KubeCon?
Exactly. So if you happen to be in Paris this week, hit me up. My schedule's about to be really full. Matt, do you have anything going on?
Not at the moment. No conferences for now until later. So
you're lucky.
Yeah.
Matt, you and I are going to have to cry in our beers.
That's right. Yeah. Let me know when you want to cry in your beer in Manhattan.
Got it. Do that. Yeah. I don't need much excuse for that. And Joe, on your flight back over the pond, you can just parachute out over New York and more.
There we go.
I'd love to. Yeah. Well, speaking of New York, I think I'm going to be at, Subservices conference, Jeremy Miller's conference. What is that? May 2nd there. So more announcements coming up there. Yep.
Cool.
Exactly. So should be good.
Okay.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for the fun chat. And again, thanks for everything you do for the community and with your writing and thought leadership. Like I said, you're one of the few analysts I pay attention to. You and Sanjeev, I think, are the two that I respect very greatly.
I look up to you guys because the fact is you basically forsook the glory path for the fact of we really need to pay attention to data engineering. And I respect you guys hugely for that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Awesome. Next week we have Martin Musial. He's going to be talking more about generative AI. And so that'll be a lot of fun. Then the week after that, we have Cedric Chen. He's speaking of people I respect a lot. I've been reading his blog Common Cog for years and finally got him on the show. So, dude's hyper smart, man. It's going to be great. So anyway, have a great day.
Hey, you too.
Have a great week. Take care, everybody.
Thanks for joining.
Bye. See ya.